All right, we're working our way through the book of James. We're up to chapter 3. And I always like to step back and get a little context for where we're at, because even chapter 3 doesn't stand alone. It's part of a five-chapter book, and you've got to kind of see where it fits in the flow and argument of the book. And James told us, really, in the first chapter, that we're to expect as Christians that we will have trials. And that was sort of the prologue for his book, is that people have trials. God will give them wisdom to deal with those trials, and they should know that God is doing something in their lives through those trials to bring them to maturity. And he says in what is really the, I think, the outline for the book and probably the main admonition, verse 19 of the first chapter, he says, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to talk." And we're going to see that play out in chapter 3. It will really bring that to the forefront. Swift to hear, slow to talk, slow to wrath. And he talks in verse 21, just two verses later, about receiving with meekness the engrafted word, which is able to save your souls, to save your lives, the substance of your life. And the bulk of chapter 2 dealt with this issue of the salvation of the soul, the idea that there is a judgment that awaits Christians, not with a view to their eternal destiny. That was finished at the cross and accomplished. You become a child of God at the point you place faith in Christ. So there's no question about that. But there is a question when we, as Paul would say in 2 Corinthians 5, he says we will all stand before Christ. And our works, our deeds, good or bad, will be dealt with there. And it's with a view to this notion of rewards and inheritance. And that's really what chapter 2 is about. And he says the standard at that judgment is basically the royal law. Love your neighbor as yourself. And he gives examples of mercy. You know, in verse 15 of chapter 2, if a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be warm and filled, notwithstanding you give them not the things which are needful of the body, what does it profit? And he's saying, what does it gain you? What's its profit? What's its wage for you personally when you stand before Christ at the judgment for Christians? Everyone's going to be judged by their works, but Christians, not with a view to their destiny. The Bible will say later, and like in Revelation, there is a time when the books are opened, and those who are not in Christ will be judged according to their works as well, but it's simply with a view to dispatching them to the lake of fire. Okay, so a very different thing. And chapter 2 is about profit, because it's not going to profit you there. Why? You're not going to get anything. You're not going to get... there's an inheritance that's prepared for us already, 1 Peter will say. But you have to appropriate that. You have to lay hold of that. And so he has that in mind in chapter 2. And really, there's a verse that's the hinge verse between chapter 2 and 3, and it's really chapter 3, verse 1, when he says, "My brethren, be not many masters," that's the word for teachers, "knowing that we shall receive a greater condemnation." He's still talking about the same judgment he was talking about in the middle of chapter 2. But this idea of teaching, now he's making a sort of transition from acts of mercy to what we say. And that gets you into chapter 3, because what you say is really a litmus for your spiritual maturity. That's why in chapter 1, be quick to hear, slow to talk. Basically what he says. And the reason is that your ability to control your tongue is probably the single best indicator of your spiritual maturity. That's all there is to it. You can, and I've seen it, and I would never do this, but I got specific names in my head of people I know, pastors, who their mouth reveals they're not qualified for the ministry because they lack maturity. And just because you can stand up on Sunday and deliver a good message actually doesn't mean you're mature. But all you have to do is listen long enough, and what you're hearing are the things you'd expect a baby to say. And he's talking about that here in chapter 3. So, be not many masters. I think James probably anticipates an issue, or he's aware of an issue, maybe in local assemblies, where everybody wants to be the person up front teaching, in a way. It's not that they're fighting for that position so much, but I think there's a lot of people who are taking on that role, maybe in an informal way. And he says, you need to be careful about that. This is one of the ways in which you're speaking But you shouldn't be doing that. You should be slow to speak in that issue. And I've seen that before. I've seen examples of people who were in a church, and just again, like one comes to mind, and it's real to me. In a church 4, 5, 6 months, and he wants to teach a Sunday school class. You've been a Christian for 6 months, and you're ready to teach. Very vocal about it. Well, okay. I mean, I like the enthusiasm. It's like I always tell some of my kids, you know, you have enthusiasm but lack experience. I mean, something to that. And I'm just saying that part of immaturity sometimes manifests as wanting to teach. It comes out, and he deals with that. He says those people are held to a greater standard. Why? Because your maturity in life needs to match what you're saying. And that's the issue. So that's chapter 3, verse 1. Then in the balance of this chapter, he's going to really get into words. So look what he says in verse 2. For in many things we offend all. He says there's a lot of ways to be offensive. He's talking about Christians being offensive. Oh my, right? He didn't talk about the unchristians. He ain't worried about them in this book. But it particularly, he says, if any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man. Don't miss that. If you don't offend with what you say, you're a perfect, that means mature man. A mature believer is what he's talking about. That's why I said this is a sort of litmus for maturity, your ability to control what you say. And I've just heard people say, well, that's just the way I am. Yeah, an immature baby. You can't have it both ways. You can't have maturity, but then when you run your mouth, you say, well, that's just the way I am. Now, everyone's going to mess up, and he's going to talk about that, but he says, if you offend not with what you say, you're mature, and you're able to bridle what the whole body. So the sins that we can do that are not speech, but the things we can engage in, he says, a good indicator of whether you can control yourself, have self-control, that's part of the fruit of the Spirit, isn't it? Self-control, so you see what we're talking about? He says, listen to what you say. And behold, he says, here's something to stare at as an example to consider. Behold, we put bits in the horse's mouths. So if you thought that was a new thing, it's not. It's been really figured out a long time ago how to make that horse go left and right. And you know what I found about a horse? You can put a bit in its mouth, and even that won't work if you don't have the reins and tell it what to do. And I remember when I was much younger, my wife, my uncle, put her on a horse, and she just refused to pull on that thing. That horse took her about 4 or 5 blocks away. All right? You see the ability to control and the actual doing, that isn't quite the same thing. But it's interesting that small, relatively small piece of metal relative to a horse that may be 16 hands, okay, with a big horse, and it'll control them. I don't care how big that horse is. You have that bit in their mouth, you can control that horse. And he says, you know, we put bits in the horse's mouth that they may obey us. And we turn about their whole body. What is he illustrating? You know, if you can control your tongue, you can control your whole body. And that's the illustration, just by analogy to a horse. If you control the bit, you control the whole horse. Okay? You've got to have your hands on the reins. And he says in verse 4, behold the ships. I'll give you another example. You know, a friend of mine, he's passed away. I actually dedicated that little Jonah book to him. But he had, on this verse, he had related this to me. He said when he was a young man, they built the first naval carrier, aircraft carrier, that had that runway at a slant instead of straight. It allowed you to make a longer runway. Okay, it's just like putting something in your garage. If you have a boat, won't fit in your garage. You put it, you slant it, and you'll get about an extra foot and a half. And he was there when they christened that ship. You know, huge ship. And the observation was that was the biggest ship at the time, I think. But you look at the back, and you know, relative to us, our height, that rudder's big, but relative to that ship, that rudder's nothing. It's very, very tiny. That little rudder controls an entire aircraft carrier, all its weight and all its strength. He says, behold the ships. And they're not as big in James's day, but the principle is the same. He says, which though they be so great, talk about in size, and are driven by fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm? He's talking about the rudder. Whithersoever the governor listeth, whichever way the pilot wants to drive the ship, he's got a fairly small wheel to turn because the rudder that actually moves it is small. It doesn't take much to do it. It's the same thing about your tongue. If you could control just that one small part, you're really going to be able to control the whole body. See, that's the idea. He says, even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. It's able to make speech and boast great words out of accord with the size of it. There's something in, you hold that thought about boasting great things. I think this popped in my head from the little book of Jude. If you go to Revelation, Jude's the page before it, like literally the page before it, okay? I think Jude and James may have known each other, right? And I think they both got to hear their brother teach, and I'm not sure they appreciated it at the time, but they came to, you know, Jude has something to say. And in fact, throughout his little book, I've went through Jude. This is a good exercise. Highlight in yellow every time it talks about speech. You know, Jude says he wants to talk about this salvation, this common salvation in verse 3. That's what he wanted to write about, but he says, I find it needful to write unto you and exhort you about false teachers. He says that you would contend for the faith, the content of the apostolic doctrine delivered to them through the apostles. He says, which was delivered once unto the saints. And he says, that's what I'm going to have to write to you about. Why? There's false teachers have crept in unawares, he says. They have snuck up on you. He got that idea from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, they're wolves in sheep's clothing. Right? That's the point. They're wearing a costume, a disguise. They sneak into where you're at, trying to take on the appearance of godliness, but they're not. And you'll know them, Jesus says, by their fruit, which by that he means their words, not their works. Because they're trying to trick you. That's the whole point. They have a disguise. But if you'll listen to them, the speech will come out. And Jude knew about this. And he says in verse 4, listen about these false teachers. Verse 4 says, I'm going to read the whole thing, denying the only Lord God. I'm just looking at all the places where it mentions speech. Verse 8, they speak evil of dignities. That's speaking most likely of angels. Because verse 9 talks about Michael the archangel, who, when he spoke to Satan about the body of Moses, something that's not recorded in the Old Testament, but there was a dispute about the body of Moses. And he compares the false teacher's speech to dignities, angels, to what even the archangel said to a fallen angel named Satan or Lucifer. Verse 10, but these, the false teachers, speak evil of those things which they know not. Verse 11, they ran greedily after the heir of Balaam. Who was Balaam? And what did he do? You remember? Way back there in the Old Testament, in Numbers, Numbers chapter 22, you have this guy who was a prophet for hire. And the Bible says he's a prophet. I think God spoke to him from time to time. But he was paid money to curse the Israelites. And, of course, he couldn't do it. But the heirs, he took the money. And so he got smart and said, well, I can't curse them. But you see those women over there that aren't Jewish? And if you'll let those young ladies, very attractive young ladies, and these young Jewish men get together, your problem will be solved pretty soon. And it was. Erubalim. So that speech, Erubalim, is false prophecy, false teaching. Verse 15, he says, listen to the whole verse. To execute judgment upon all, and to convince, which means convict, all that are ungodly among them, ungodly among the false teachers, of all their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly admitted, there's a key term here, and of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him, against Christ. Speech again. Verse 16, these are murmurers, complainers, Baptists, walking after their own lust, and their mouth speaks great swelling words. Now, what James just said, that the tongue speaks great things? Great swelling words. This is why I mean, you just don't want to be a murmurer, a complainer in a church because you're fitting right within this verse. And I know he's talking about false teachers, but God's going to get after you too. But all of these things, all these speeches is tied up with these guys that, as far as I can tell from the book of Jude, are not believers at all. They're false teachers. And why would you want to be like that as a Christian? So that's the whole point. We're not to be like that. We're to be different. Verse 18, how is it they told you there should be mockers in the last time? Speech. Over and over. You know, there's someone else who speaks great words. I'm going to turn back to the book of Daniel. Way back in the Old Testament. First of our minor prophets. One of the most significant prophetic books in the Old Testament for us understanding the future. Look at Daniel 7. Daniel 7, verse 11. You know, there's a vision in Daniel 7 where he sees these beasts. And somewhere in the church, we I think have Eddie's drawing of Daniel 7. There's a bear and some other animals that come out of the sea. And he sees them, and the fourth one's like not like the others, and he's got the horns on his head and all that stuff. And then he peers into heaven and sees one like the Son of Man come on the clouds, which is exactly the way Acts 1 says he'll return. There's not coincidence. Who goes in, you know, he's in the throne room of God, and then he switches back to the vision. And it says in verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. It's one of the horns, and we identify him as the Antichrist. Sometimes we use that term. But on that fourth beast, there was a horn. And what does he do? He speaks great words. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given the burning flame. One of the marks of the Antichrist is speaking great words, which is similar to these false teachers here in the book of Jude. If you bump up to verse 25 in the same chapter of Daniel, again speaking, so verse 24 says, the ten horns, that's on top of the head of that beast, the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise. This is still future for us. And another shall rise after them. That's the 11th horn. And that's the one, again, that people usually will refer to as the Antichrist. That's a term that John uses in one of his writings. It says, another shall arise after them and shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings, and he shall speak great words against who? The Most High. And he shall wear out the saints. That's abuse. That's persecution. So the 11th horn, this Antichrist, one of his hallmarks is his babbling, his running of the mouth. It's amazing how people often don't just pause to listen to what they're hearing. The other things distract us, and that's what he's looking at. Bump up to Revelation 13 for a minute, and you'll see this thing. And I'm showing you these because, for the Christian, why would you want to speak like that? Why would you, if someone said, well, what's their speech like, the Antichrist? That really what you want? Revelation 13, this is the chapter where John will introduce two figures in history future, which one of them is this, sometimes we call him the beast, who is the false prophet, and there's another one that's the Antichrist figure. Chapter 13, verse 1 says, I stood upon the stand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, just like in Daniel 7. And if you look at Eddie's picture, it's based on Daniel, but they're coming out of the sea. It's what's behind them. It's the same thing. And if you look up in verse 5 of this chapter 13, talking of this beast that came out of the sea, it is notable in the first verse, having seven heads and ten horns. The ten horns match what the beast of Revelation 7 had. Verse 5 here, I said Revelation 7, I meant Daniel 7. Verse 5 of Revelation 13, there was given unto him a mouth. Oh my. Now we're back in the book of James. A mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. That's right out of Daniel 7. Great things against the Most High. That's what we call blasphemy, to speak against God. Great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. In other words, he's got 3.5 years to exercise some degree of power. Verse 11, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. See, the one out of the sea is the one we usually call the Antichrist. The one out of the earth is, what should we call him? A priest, a preacher, something like that. He's a religious figure whose job it is to get people to worship the one who's called Antichrist. Antichrist isn't so much meaning against Christ as it is to mean a counterfeit of. He will hold himself out as the great Savior for the people of the world, and a lot of people are going to go after him. And one reason is this guy that comes out of the land. And it says in verse 11, this beast came up out of the land, and he had two horns like a lamb. Remember what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? Those wolves dress up in sheep's clothing. No, we think of little white fluffy sheeps, but a lot of the sheep, you know, they have horns. A peaceful lamb, a little lamb out of the land. Then what's it say? And he spake as a dragon. See that? But who's listening? You see, it only matters that they promise. They promise me something: peace, and safety, and security. Who's listening, right? Just a little detour there, but you want to see the how speech fits in. James doesn't want his audience to act like unbelievers, to act like immature believers, or to even to act like Satan. Peter tells Jesus, "You can't do that. You can't go to the cross. Stand behind me, Satan." Whose words was he speaking in that moment? See, as a Christian, you can do that. So here in the book of James, we have to take this very seriously, that verse 6 says the tongue is a fire. Verse 5 says the tongue is a little member, but behold, great a matter, a little fire kindleth. This, you know, we don't deal with this as much, although, you know, it was California with their wildfires, although we did, I'm losing track of time, but it was within the last maybe 6 years, because it was while I worked at my current firm, Bastrop, Texas. Most of it was on fire. It turns out I had bought my dog. I'd bought my dog there, and I contacted the fellow I'd bought it from. He was a retired medical doctor that breeds these dogs, but he lost everything. I mean, it just, you know, had to get rid of the dogs, and he was raising animals for the state of Texas for some kind of preservation thing, but just everything burned down. Someone I worked with, his parents' house, everything burned down. If you go to that part of Bastrop, it was all pine trees. There was a story behind it, because you don't naturally have pine trees, but someone planted them 100-something years ago, and a lot of it's just gone. And in those fires like that, it's usually something simple. Someone just being silly with, you know, not putting their fire out, if they're camping, cigarette butt, that kind of thing. How small a spark can go and take 10,000 acres with it, and lives and all of that. And just as destructive and deadly as that fire that seems to always be burning in California, so it is with your words. You think it's a little thing, and then to come back later, you know, you caused 10,000 acres to burn, a bunch of people lost their homes, some people died. You're the one that flicked the cigarette. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry. Well, so what? Who cares if you're sorry? You know, I'm serious. Let's be. You know, because there's too many people that think when they say I'm sorry, that they're like a get out of jail free card in Monopoly. Oh, I'm. You know, I said I was sorry. I don't care. And you know, because you can't unring the bell. People will forget kind words sometimes, but they'll never forget the mean words. The mean words are still there 50 years later. Sometimes, if the right person said it to you, and you cause, you know, this great damage, you can't just undo it. I mean, you ought to apologize, but I'm just telling you, that's what he's talking about. If you think about the ramifications of some of the things you can say, that ought to cause you to back up and think twice about it. Before you burn down the forest, what are you going to say? And we'll look at real quick in a minute at a standard for that, but let's look at these verses quickly here, and I'm going to show you a few other things about words. He says in verse 7, well, by the way, in verse 6, he says, you know, your speech, it's a world of iniquity. Now, sometimes people say stupid things, and you know, this old Jerry Lee Lewis song, just saying that should tell you where I'm going. Jerry Lee Lewis, the whiskey made me do it. That's how people are. I can think of someone in Hollywood who had a long anti-Semitic rant while he was drunk, and to sort of say later, well, it's not really what I, it's not really me, because the whiskey loosens your tongue, but it don't put the stuff in your heart. Jesus was very clear that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. You see, circumstances don't create your spirit. They just reveal what's there, including loosening the tongue with liquor or whatever else it is. And people are more free and easy with their words, but the thoughts were already there. They're just not being as controlled in saying it. He says there's a root of iniquity all in there in that tongue. So is the tongue among our members. It defiles the whole body. It sets on fire the course of nature. Burn down the whole forest. It set on the fire of hell. For every kind of beast and of birds and of serpents and things in the sea is tamed. There's not an animal that we're not able to tame, basically, in this world as we know it, except the tongue. And that's the one thing we just can't tame. And he says the tongue no man can tame, verse 8. It's an unruly evil full of poison, deadly poison. Why? You use it to kill, right? And you can destroy lives. And I hasten to add, this isn't just figurative. We have an upswing in suicide for a number of reasons, but one of the more disturbing ones, besides the unusually high incidence of suicide among veterans, is young people who feel bullied. Hateful words are said, and I can just read what I see. Young person, even as young as 12, taking their life and writing a letter to mom and dad about being bullied and stuff. Why they bully the kids at school. Children are just mirrors. They're just doing what mom and dad do, one or both of them. So, but it happens. But words can be destructive, and especially like in that context. And we can look back and say, well, they should just be tougher. People ought to control their words. Christians, they're not. And parents don't often give them the tools. I mean, it's just a truth. If I have a young child, 4 or 5, who come at my house on a visit, and you ask them to do something, they say no. I know that there's an authority problem at home. They're just responders, and I usually know whose fault it is. And 99% of the time, it's dad. That's just how it is. But the words we have to teach our children about speech. Speech can cause a lot of hurt, and just can't unring the bell. And it can even cause people to take their lives. It can cause people to lose a career. There's an article the other day, and I know it's just an outright lie, but speech matters. A young lady who accused a number of football players at a school of raping her and then said later she made it all up. Well, I'm sorry. Okay. Because when that happens, people lose scholarships, lose future, lose a lot of things. He says in verse 9, therewith, that's with our tongue, we bless God, even the Father, and wherewith we curse men, which are made out of the same, after the same similitude of God. You know, the way this looks, and again, I don't mention any specific name, but I'm just telling you this isn't a made-up example. I get a Facebook post, and some of y'all don't do Facebook, so this doesn't mean anything to you, but, it's a praise Jesus, share, amen, all that stuff. And then the same person does a Facebook post that says, Michelle Obama lost her law license in Illinois because of criminal activity, which I know is false. You may not like her. You may even hate her as a Christian. Is there Christian hate? Is that? I think some people do, judging from the post. But you can go on the website of any state in this country and check who has an active law license. So I was curious, and I checked the website for the state of Illinois, and she's got a law license. So I just said, well, what evidence do you have that she lost her law license because of criminal activity? I read. That's the response. Me respond. I read too. What evidence? He says, you're just a liberal Democrat moron that doesn't know anything. Well, I didn't post anything else after that. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. Maybe it's a shock to y'all. But one thing I am, and I try to be, is honest and not lazy. I can't stand either one of them. The Proverbs says a lazy person is a fool. And if you lack integrity, Jesus made it pretty simple. Make your yay, yay. But, under the laws in Texas, the civil law, if I say something about you that destroys your livelihood, but it was all true, I find out about some skeleton in the closet. Maybe you're a high school teacher and you've been there for 30 years, but I find out you had a DUI when you were 17, and I put it out there. The law of Texas says as long as it's true, that's fine. What does God's rule say? The rule's real simple. If you can't edify by what you're going to say, don't say it. We'll see that in Ephesians. So some people think the truth is a defense. What if I say something like this lady lost her law license because she's a criminal, and I haven't done either one, I know it's false, or two, I've done nothing to verify it. Put aside the fact that I'm not following what God said about only speaking those things which will edify. Because even if it were true, I'm not sure how it would edify anybody. She's not the president or even close. But what if I have no basis for knowing whatsoever? Isn't that what we do when we gossip? Did you hear what so-and-so? Don't tell anybody else. If you've got to say don't tell anybody else, why are you? You know, you shouldn't say something to somebody you wouldn't say if the person you're talking about was in the room with you. You ask yourself basic questions. Would the person I'm talking about want me to share? Is the person I'm sharing it with part of the problem or part of a solution to the problem? I mean, this isn't rocket science. But see, the fact that it's not true just doesn't matter. Or the fact that it is true doesn't matter. But we need to think about these things, and we need to especially think about verifying our facts before we start running our mouth, as say in East Texas, running our mouth about things that we don't even know. And just because I might hate somebody, I know we're not supposed to say that, but that's, I mean, I know the people hate people. That's not a license, nor is the fact that they're a public figure a license to go running your mouth about that person with things you don't know if it's true. And a lot of things are easy to verify. But you also can't sweep it all under a conspiracy rug and say, well, I mean, you know, the government hid it from you. Okay, maybe the black choppers are going to come land in my front lawn and try to take my AR from me today and all that stuff, whatever. But let's be reasonable as Christians and think about what God says about speech. He says, you bless God and then you curse somebody that God made, at, you know, both sides of your mouth. And that's the kind of thing I see for some Christians in social media, and you'll hear it. And James is saying, yeah, you lack maturity. That's abiding criticism. Your speech has revealed your lack of maturity. That's what the whole chapter is about. He says in verse 11, does a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? No, it's a rhetorical question. You see what he's saying is you're a bad fountain. Just because you can praise Jesus one moment and curse someone else the next, that doesn't mean that you could be a good fountain. A good fountain can only send forth good water, so you are, in fact, a bad fountain. That's his point. Verse 12, a fig tree, my brethren, can it bear olive berries? No. If you're bearing a hateful speech, then you're a hateful speech tree. That's all there is to it. You can't claim to be an apple tree or even a fig tree. Either a vine, figs, you know, does grapevine produce figs? No. So can a fountain yield salt water and fresh? No. This thing about words, I'm going to mention some principles. We're not going to have time to go back and show them to you because we took a little detour on this Antichrist speech. But some principles about words quickly as we bring it to a close. I'm just going to say these and just you can kind of chew on them. One, think before you speak. That is James chapter 1. Quick to listen, but slow to speak. Think before you speak. Two, recognize the power of your words. I've mentioned those just by example, but that's James 3. You can get it from the Proverbs as well, but James 3 says, you know, a small spark kindles a large, damaging fire. Destructive areas of speech that spark fires, of course, are gossip, and that includes things that are true, but no one else has a need to know. It is okay to know something that no one else knows about. And if you cannot restrain yourself from telling them, it's you that have a defect, a problem, a spiritual problem, not the person you're going to talk about. Slander, that's your speech that just lies about people with the intent of causing an injury. And malice, these are all things the Bible uses these words. Principle number three, there's nothing edifying or godly about gossip. Principle number four, people are not to associate themselves with others who gossip or slander. That's from the book of Proverbs. He says don't even hang around those people. Principle 5, our words validate the reality of what's inside our hearts. That's what Jesus said, Matthew 12. Our words will validate the reality of what's inside our hearts. And Principle 6, before you say it, ask whether it will edify the hearer. Ephesians 4:29, which is the last verse I will read to you and where we'll end. Ephesians 4:29. Paul says there, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. That sort of sums up James chapter 3 in a short few words. But that which is good to the use of edifying, that's the grid. Think about this as you not only say things, but write them. And that's why I'm very sensitive, I try to be, and I can't say I've always done as well as I should, about what I write, not just in social media, but as a litigation attorney, people usually have no self-control in their emails. And in the modern day, when you litigate, you go get their emails. I can guarantee you this, if you're in the workforce and you have forwarded a crude joke or pornography, if there's a lawsuit against the company in any way involves you, even tangentially, your boss is going to see all that, and you will probably get fired. I'm just saying, I mean, like it happens all the time. You'd be just surprised how you have to sift through when you get people's emails this trash, but there's no inhibition. And so I'm just saying it's not just your speech when you're talking publicly, but in other areas where we put down our thoughts, we need to let no corrupt communication proceed out of our mouth, but that which is good to the edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers. If it doesn't, then we shouldn't say it. Pretty simple. Other kinds of speech, corrupt communications, can cause much damage, and even our earnest apologies won't take those consequences away.